Welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
Hey, and Crash, if you don't mind, I know we put the show on hiatus, but before we get into the review, I want to do a mini B-roll, just because I found out something today that's just so stupid it's funny to me.
Oh, by all means.
So, now of course, Black Adam is opening this Friday, right? And pretty much from
to the not rave reviews, it seems.
Oh, it's literally they have followed the standard DC pattern of all the first reviews are absolutely glowing, and then the second wave of reviews comes out.
It is shit on toast, and I don't like toast.
But now, like, from the moment The Rock started doing his press tour and massive promotion and everything he can to sell the movie, the Snyder Bros have been singing his praises to almost Zack Snyder levels. This man has become not just the most electrifying man in all of entertainment, but he has become their second messiah. They consider him the second coming of the DCEU.
Like, you know, there are not many times I pine for the days of the Attitude Era, but if OG Rock had a legitimate, like, bizarre cult surrounding him that wasn't manufactured by WWE, could you fucking imagine just how he would eat that up?
Like, oh my god, like, yeah.
His goddamn, like intros to the ring would have to be 20 minutes because the crowd would not shut the fuck up.
Oh. Most of his intros, I think, were 20 minutes, and if they weren't, the promos definitely were. But
I mean, hey, come on, a conservative 15. A conservative 15.
But like I said, the Snyder Bros have been singing his praises. They have been swearing up and down about how he is going to bring the Snyderverse back. They've won. Black Adam is the start of the revolution. Yada yada yada. Guess what I found out started today?
It's the first sign. The first seal has been broken.
You know what started today? By the Snyder Bros? Ah. Hashtag boycott Black Adam.
Bah?
The movie has not even premiered yet, and they have already turned on it. Now, as I understand it, the basic logic is now this. Apparently, they've decided that because The Rock has pitched his own version of the DCEU to David Zaslav, and that will be what they're going to go with going forward.
Hold on. Wait, excuse me. Wait. Are you telling me that he is now the Kevin Feige of the DCEU?
Right?
The Rock? Oh, God, that man is going to become president someday. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Now it's a giant conspiracy because he's pitching his own DC Extended Universe instead of the Snyderverse. So now he's a blight on the existence of cinema, and they want everyone to boycott Black Adam, the movie that they've been singing the praises of, because it may or may not be bringing Superman back in the post-credit stinger. But it's not even out yet, and they have already turned.
Oh my god, that is fascinating and just incredibly stupid.
I saw the hashtag today.
The passengers on the the Titanic have now turned on each other and are attempting to satiate their bloodlust while sacrificing the first class passengers to the god of the ocean, Poseidon himself, in the hopes that he will spare the rest. What the fuck?
Yeah, like, it's so amazing, just all or nothing. But the waiting for, though, is the TikTok users that I have mentioned before, like Lex Reviews and Soups, who are still on the, we've done it, we've brought back the Snyderverse train. You didn't do a goddamn thing, first of all. Second, I'm waiting to see just how long it takes for them to jump onto the boycott Black Adam train. But yeah, I saw that hashtag today. I was like, I know we're not doing the B-roll, but I can't pass this up.
Too good not to. Too good not to. But what we are here for today is the last of our, we never came up with a proper name for it, late 1970s to 1980s live action Disney Afonorama 2022. This time for real, the revengeing. with a film that, I don't know, this thing is an engine for deja vu for me. Not nostalgia, deja vu. Because yeah. I first saw it when I think I was 3. So, like, I have sense memory of it. I had no actual recollection of the plot whatsoever. This is 1986's The Flight of the Navigator!
When you're just growing up, every day is a new discovery. But nothing David Freeman has ever experienced will prepare him for the adventure that lies ahead.
Sit down.
I think there's been some sort of mistake.
Your brain contains data necessary to get me and my friends home.
I'm just a kid.
You are the Navigator.
Walt Disney Pictures presents a new adventure fantasy.
What are you doing?
Above and beyond the ordinary.
Take me back!
Okay.
Oh no!
Flight of the Navigator.
Do something!
You're the Navigator, not me.
20,000 feet and falling.
Come on, one of these hasn't started.
His mind is the key to an adventure on the most fantastic hot rod in the universe. A story of a spaceship.
That flying saucer's first rate.
Be cool, dudes.
A friendship.
I'm gonna miss you.
I'm going to miss you, too.
And an experience beyond imagination.
Don't you want to take a turnpike?
I'm the Navigator.
Flight of the Navigator. Disney's new adventure fantasy.
First question out the block, and I have to do it. I have to do it.
Yep.
If Max got his personality from the imprint from David, but David went missing in 1978, why does Max sound like Pee Wee Herman?
There's a very, very simple reason for that. He's played by Pee Wee Herman.
Don't tell me a logical fucking reason. Fuck you. If he is imprinting and his personality comes from a child from 1978, we need to have, like, I don't know, the bartender from the Love Boat or some shit. The original Admiral Adama comes through, all Lord Greedy and everything. Charlie's Angels, except it's Charlie.
On the one hand, you're telling me not to bring logic into this, and yet here you are.
Listen, when I say it, it matters and it's important. When other people say it, less so.
The simple fact is, this is a Norwegian independent film. And I am dead serious. That was made the height of Pee Wee Herman, of Short Circuit. It doesn't make sense, but with Max, there was really only one thing they were going to do. how we got to Max's personality doesn't make a lick of sense cinematically.
No, no, whatsoever.
Practically, on the other hand.
Obviously, I can understand that you have Pee-wee himself performing the voice, and it's like it's stunt casting, as you say, chasing the money and success of Short Circuit, and instead coming up with something that is very odd, not in a bad way, just a different way. This is like the Star Trek of this is the Star Trek and Arthur C. Clarke, like, taking itself a little serious, a little more serious than usual, Disney sci-fi of the 80s. Like, if this had been published in the mid-60s as a little pulp novel, I would not be shocked or surprised or amazed. But it would be an amazing story to astound.
Well, if it was an amazing story, then it would have been a Steven Spielberg special. There's your reference.
There you go. But like, it's a fascinating film in the sense of like, this could have gone so cliche in so many ways. It's so close to E.T. and if it had strayed too close to that, people would just consider it an E.T. clone. Somehow it manages to avoid that. It's so close to Short Circuit, and yet it manages to have its own identity. I will admit that having Pee-wee Herman's voice come out of the goddamn robot certainly makes it unique. And the fact that there's no villains in this, like, there's antagonists, yes.
Yeah.
But honestly, it's just NASA being like, child, I need you to understand. You have made first contact. We need you to tell us everything. We're NASA. You have star charts in your brain that we will never get our hands on in like 1,000 years. You have somewhere locked inside access through computer interfaces, Wi-Fi, by the way, how the hell that works, light speed technology that can get you like 256 light years away in 2.2 days. Excuse me. I'm pretty sure not even Federation technology could pull that shit. Gimme, kid.
Oh no,
kid. Gimme. It's okay if the federal government kills this one child if we get FTL.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can 100% see why Disney picked this up for distribution. Like, this is a surprisingly well done man versus himself coming of age type story that I don't think Disney itself would have actually thought of.
No, I feel like the... Like, there are aspects of Disneyfication to it. The happy ending at the end when, like, no, time travel is not possible with you. Time travel is not possible with you. Okay, you've earned it. Sure, it's fine. I'll admit, I was just being a dickhead before.
Well, I think that was actually one of the few issues that I had with it. That scene right there. Because... They set up the idea that, you know, I brought you back 8 years later because you're human and time travel is potentially lethal and I don't want you to die.
Yeah.
And then when our protagonist, David, makes one of the most grown-up decisions I've ever seen a kid in a Disney movie make, and it is well executed, I gotta give him that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And decides to risk going back in time anyway. Visually, it's a well done sequence. The stakes have been set up, but not followed through on.
Yeah, it really is crying out for a Planet of the Apes reveal where, like, the kid gets thrown through time, but he, like, I don't know, ends up in, let's see, he's living in Florida, right? Fort Lauderdale. So, he comes across some Spanish conquistadors or something. You know, like, it's fucking Pancho Villa, or not Pancho Villa, fucking Cortez or whoever the hell landed on Florida and their ridiculous pantaloons. And he's like, oh no, oh no. And then, like, pulls up or something into the sky, and you see the ship fly by. So it's like, oh, you have the option for a sequel. Or maybe the kid is stuck in the past. Ah, whatever. There are options that they could have gone with, and just having it end happily ever after, regardless, with no, like, literally undoing the entire story is just like, oh. Oh. Well, that's frustrating, because at least if The Wizard of Oz is all a dream, we get some sweet psychoanalyzation of Dorothy Gale's mind. This is just a bait and switch.
Well, the very ending, I didn't have a problem specifically with that. I think it was more, if we had seen David struggling during the time travel, or showing that he was at least in some degree of pain, so that as the viewer, we're sitting there not knowing if he's going to survive this trip, that ending gets earned a little more.
It's not only that it's not bad, it's like, oh, it kind of tickles and tastes like bubblegum. It's like, oh, it turns out there was no problem. Why did you hesitate? Oh, I thought he hated bubblegum. Oh, well.
And I mean, like, maybe they didn't know how to get that necessary performance out of the actor, or Disney bought it for distribution and was like, yeah, actually, we'd like you to redo this one part, or...
And that kind of thing, yeah. Exactly, like, is why I suspect. Like, there are elements of Disneyfication throughout this that, like, you could have a pretty decent, you know, still G or PG sci-fi that the whole family could enjoy, but it'd be a little more serious and straightforward. And instead, you get something that has, like tells of Disney, such as the voice of the robot when it becomes, like more personable, be an actor like Pee Wee Herman, or, you know, something silly like that. Having the child have a sibling who at first, you know, there's the typical, like, Disney sibling, you know, child rivalry kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
But the sibling grows up to be, like, actually really kind of cool and supportive and stuff. And it's like, I read somewhere that one of the reviews of this movie was that it presented, at the time, one of the best and most, like, natural representations of an American family, where it's just, no, we don't care. We care about our kid. And here's a brother who, like, is, like, actually somehow supportive. It's like, that's fascinating. They're an oddly human couple. It's almost as if they've made this film around some people that they have convinced are actually a family. And they're ever so patient about it. They never lose their temper, but, like, it's just, like, constantly pushing them a little bit. Like, are you gonna even, like, resist a little bit? We got your kid. We got your kid. It's the most non-threatening story about kidnapping
ever.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. I mean, the simple fact is there's not much of an actual plot here. I mean, the story is basically kid gets kidnapped by an alien spacecraft. Kid takes said alien spacecraft for a joyride.
Mm-hmm. Time dilation, relativity.
Yeah. And that's like the first about 2.5 acts of the movie right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, he comes back and people want to study him. There's not exactly much of a hunt and chase. And the antagonist, I will not call them bad guys because they are clearly not bad guys.
No.
You know, they're just working to try to get these answers and find this kid. And yes, they do lock him up in a secure facility. And I do love that the kid at some point jokes like, oh, I'm a threat to national security. And it's like, this probably happened. Yeah, you kind of really are, kid. But they're really, really nice about it. Like at this stage in the 80s, this would have been considered like, oh my God, the government's coming to get you. Ooh, it's so threatening, yeah. And such. Now it's just like, are you kidding? They feed you with a robot and you get a girlfriend. What? It's prison of a sorts, but did you see how many fucking Transformers he got?
So speaking of which, the number of Transformers that he got was actually one.
What, just moved around shot to shot? Yeah, he got one version of the same Transformer.
Oh no, it was literally, I think there's a couple of shots where you see multiple Transformers boxes, but they're the same one.
Oh no, you dickheads. Why would you do that? I mean, first of all, he doesn't know what the fuck a Transformer is.
True.
But second, then you load him up with repeats, doubles. Oh, you pricks. I think it's Scorponok, and like, who the fuck gave a shit about Scorponok?
No, I think this was in terms of the toy line, this would have been pre-Scorponok. It was even worse because it was one of the a random Insecticon.
Oh, that's why I thought it was Scorponok. Because yeah, like my first memory of Scorponok was him being melted to death by Unicron. Thanks, Marvel Comics. So when he popped back up in Beasties a decade later, I was like, I know that guy. I saw him die.
In terms of the original cartoon, the Insecticons were, I think, season 2, maybe late season 1, but Scorponok was season 3.
Nonsense and madness. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I say season 3, but that was like 4 episodes and a special. Like, season 3 was literally one story.
And you know that the reason it's there and not, say, you know, Optimus Prime is because they were just like, next wave. It's like, why the fuck would this child want this goddamn toy? No, at least get him Optimus. No, at least get him Megatron. Then he has a gun. But yeah, he gets locked up with Sarah Jessica Parker, which I guess that's a kind of like cruel torture.
Well, apparently that's how Sarah Jessica Parker looks at this movie.
Right. I can understand that. She's more a function than a character.
Yeah, it's very much a function. There's actually a quote from her somewhere here in the IMDb trivia where somebody had asked her about Flight of the Navigator.
Yeah.
So in 2018, I guess she did an interview with something called the Random Roles interview with the AV Club, which I have no idea what that is.
AV Club, excellent media critics.
Apparently, she had very little recollection or affection for the film. She was asked what drew her to Flight of the Navigator, and she said, quote, what drew me to Flight of the... Are you seriously asking me what drew me to Flight of the Navigator? It was a part. Like, literally, I just got a part. I went and did it. That's what I did for most of my career. Nothing drew me to it. I can't... It was a job. That's exactly a paycheck. That's exactly what drew me to it. I can't even tell you what it was about or who I played. You know, all you want is a job. You're auditioning. You want to have as much experience as possible. You know, it was great. End quote.
Like, did that person just read a list of movie appearances and not even consider A, how they appear in the movie or their part, or like B, years, time, the passage of?
Well, see, I read this and I'm just kind of curious what the structure of that particular episode was. Like, was this an episode about Flight of the Navigator? Or
no,
were they just
no,
talking
I would,
about
I would
like...
say it's... Yeah, I would say it's just a an interview with her about her career, and they're talking about the larger aspects and when she actually had like choices in the role. And perhaps the question was asked to throw her, knowing that it would get a response, you know, like asking Matthew McConaughey about Chainsaw 3, 4, whatever. And seeing how fast he decks you. But like, I can understand her not liking this movie. There, as I said before, her character is a function, not an object, or a function, not a like an actual person in any sort. Not even like, I mean, she's two dimensional, but in typical media that has like a child get kidnapped by the government for reasons, after they exhibit incredible powers, and such. Or are connected to an alien. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
The carrot that comes along, that is the opposite of the stick that is the government enforcement, usually at some point betrays that character. Like, it's necessary to understand that she is an employee of the same organization that has kidnapped that kid. She is not, like, unaware of why that kid is there or how they got the kid there or how long the kid will be there, because she read it on a timesheet. She was totally normal about, like, oh, you're the new one, come in. And it's like, how many other unconstitutional prisoners has NASA taken that you are just, like, normalizing this shit with? At some point, she should have taken the information she gathered from the kid and informed NASA about it, and he should have had to, like, break out in spite of her after, like, she's revealed to be betraying him. But they don't even have an antagonist to that extent in this movie. Things occur. Things occur. They are not driven by anyone. Really? Except, like relativity is why this plot occurs. That's it. Why is the reason?
Yeah.
Because if you travel too far for too long at light speed, shit gets weird with time. Sorry about that. Everyone you know is dead. I mean, he's just lucky.
To go back to one of your earlier points for a second, there is another detail that you might have overlooked, was the simple fact that David's room, that those child quarters are set up awful perfectly for him, awful quickly.
All I'm saying is NASA has always kidnapped children. Anyway.
Exactly.
No, that is not true. Do not sue me, NASA. Do not sue me. Do not sue me. They do not kidnap the children. They just launch them into orbit without consent. Anyway.
Yeah, they subcontract to the CIA for the kidnapping.
I mean, you know, like, they're scientists and nerds.
I mean,
they can't handle that shit.
Yeah.
Nerds!
This is a NASA project being led by Dr. Johnny Fever. Come on.
And like, I love that he's the most intimidating character in this movie. And it's just, nah, No, it's fine. I'm pretty sure you're wearing loafers. You are not a villain, sir. In the great chain of Disney villains from the bitch-ass queen witch in Snow White to whoever the fuck is in the latest Pixar movie, I don't know. You do not count whatsoever. You're nowhere near that chain. You are on the other side of the room.
I mean, let's be honest. To be perfectly honest here, you could take Carol and Sarah Jessica Parker's character out entirely. Mm-hmm. Tweak Howard Hessman's Dr. Faraday just a little bit. So that he's the one that finally goes, David, you got to get out of here.
Now that would actually be interesting. Yes, some character development from the jailer. So you're expecting it from a couple of other places, and no, it comes from the jailer, who's like, there's nothing more we can learn from the kid, but they're not going to just let him go anymore. It's too deep. It's, you know, too much has been exposed, et cetera, et cetera. He's seen too much. And so he lets the kid go. That would have been something. Instead, like kudos to Sarah Jessica Parker's character for being easily talked into committing a federal offense by a child. You're fired. Also, you're under arrest. Have you ever heard of holding? You're gonna spend your life there. You're not gonna leave this small room ever again.
Like I said, it's a very simple plot. It's there's something calming and almost soothing as you're watching it, but at the same time, you're both left wanting more. But there's also that large degree of, hold on.
Yeah, why? Wait a minute. No, hold. There's so much potential in this. First of all, the ship is beautiful. Incredible effect for the time to have it reflective of the surfaces that it flies over. That's where the money of this movie went.
Prequels would like to say thank you.
Yes, my God. Naboo owes you a debt of gratitude.
I'm sorry, you're not going to tell me that they did not take the inspiration for Nubian starships from Flight of the Navigator.
I mean, it elongates. No. Yeah, no. That's,
yeah.
That's absolutely the royal, I don't know, yacht. The one that doesn't get blowed up.
Yes, they obviously pulled from the SR-71 Blackbird, but come on.
Yeah. If this movie had continued down its logical plot, they would have presented like the U.S. government coming up with versions of the Blackbird prototype mixed with the spaceship, and they would look exactly like a Naboo royal yacht. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Mm. Mm. That is a sexy fucking starship.
I mean, you are not wrong.
Naboo fucking engineering. Pretty. Anyway. there's a lot that could be deeper explored with this film, except that's not its intent. Its intent is to just tell this simple little child story that, like, it feels like a storybook, really, in many ways. There's no real escalation. The connection between elements in the plot don't really come into question. The child is not really endangered at any point. Like, the most endangered the child is when he falls into the ravine at the beginning. And that is swept aside as a concern immediately. So,
especially since that kid should be dead.
Yeah, that kid should definitely be dead. I always kind of thought he did die, and like and Max brought him back, and that's how he became the Navigator. It's kind of one of those things of like, well, you're dead. Might as well find some good use for you. It's like a USB with legs. Also, why is it sitting in the pilot seat? Get out. Get out.
And, I mean, Max is also an anthropological, like, zoology ship.
Yeah, so yeah, that no, works. Not at all Brainiac. No, it's fine. It's not at all Brainiac. That's how this movie should have ended. It should have ended they reached the climax. It's the same climax, exact same, but right before the kid goes back in time, Superman fucking just drops out of the sky and says, Brainiac, let that kid go. You're wanted for temporal crimes. You kidnapped this child and I've been chasing you for 8 years.
Well, speaking of temporal crimes, we could go back in time, make that adjustment to the movie, and then save the world from Superman 4.
Oh, tempting. Tempting. And then land back just in time to have Max take the place of the computer in Superman 3, and thus giving us the correct Richard Donner Superman 3 with Brainiac.
Proper. There we go. There we go.
Richard Pryor can stay.
Just to go back to the visual effects for a second, there was a note that I just found that I was looking for. Director Randall Kleiser brought in his brother Jeff as the visual effects supervisor, who oversaw the use of reflection mapping software.
Don't worry, guys, Jeff's here.
Actually, that's you joke, but that's a very valid reaction. Jeff, who oversaw the use of reflection mapping software to create the ship's chrome-like appearance. The result was one of the first successful examples of what would later be known as CGI. Another going to a film that we need to cover at some point, which is Labyrinth. A full 5 years before the groundbreaking T-1000 of Terminator 2 Judgment Day, which came out in 1991.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And absolutely needed this film to develop this first. Yeah. Yeah. Now, different kind of reflections due to different materials and amount of time a reflection would stay in. So, yes, the T-1000 is far, far, far more difficult, but this was literally groundbreaking. You can't have any of what you get after. You can't have those water reflections in video games you don't even fucking notice anymore. But every video game that has water in it has painstakingly developed a reflection engine. And it all came from this. It all came from Jeff. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Hefe.
That's right. Jeff walked so James Cameron could run. How many people can say that?
James Cameron will never say that.
Hell no.
James Cameron walked so that great James Cameron could run, so that James Cameron could jump, so that James Cameron could fly, because James Cameron doesn't let gravity hold him the fuck down.
and with his love of underwater, he clearly doesn't let buoyancy affect him either.
James Cameron is not affected by the laws of nature. Woo!
Yeah. I think, like I've said before, this is very much one of those. There's not much to it. But it still left me going, how did I not go back to this sooner?
Well, that's the odd thing. So, like,
yeah,
as I said, I first watched this when I was 3. And so I have, like, vague memories tied to it of, like, Wonderful World of Disney and all that jazz. Like, you know, the intro that they used to have with the compass that would go around leading up to a movie presentation. Because, of course, it was the era of VHS. My folks would record those episodes onto tapes. And so I would have, like, a completely illegal stash of Disney films at the tender age of, like, 3 to 7. Oh, always a pirate, once a pirate, once a pirate, always a pirate. Once a pirate, always a pirate. Anyway.
So so basically what you're saying is that your formative years were spent robbing the Disney vault.
I mean, I didn't know I was robbing it. That hole was always there, officer.
At the age like the of fucking five. Beagle Boys. At the age of five, you were stealing from the impregnable, impossible to even locate Disney vault.
I didn't know it was a problem. I thought you just did it. Anyway.
This is the kid-friendly Ocean's 11 prequel we did not know that we needed.
Ah. But at some point, I think in college, when I was really bored and on other things, I rewatched it thinking like, oh, I wonder if I can reconnect with some nostalgia. That'll definitely make this thing that I'm currently doing more interesting. And I did at some point rewatch it. So I do remember like more detailed aspects of the plot and character and such. But, you know, this film is weirdly forgettable, so I completely understand not coming back to it. Whenever you do remember it, you're like, oh yeah, Flight of the Navigator.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. But every other moment of your life is not spent thinking about Poochie and wondering where Poochie is. This is not E.T. It doesn't come up in the zeitgeist nearly enough, if at all. Maybe like one Family Guy joke at some point. Like, Max doesn't even show up in, like, off nostalgia coming out of Disney. You don't even get, like, sarcastic jokes in the background of Chippendale.
So basically what you're saying is they screwed the Poochie.
Well done.
I want a Caruso for that.
That was good.
Oh, I'm so proud of that.
Well, be more proud of that than Disney is of this film, because, yeah, it's not that they buried it, they just forgot it was in that pile, and you keep adding to the pile, and, you know, you end up burying things.
And the hilarious thing is if you think about it, it was buried with money.
Yes.
Because, like, this is that mid-range film that they were cranking out or buying up for ages, specifically for the weekly Wonderful World of Disney. And then things like Marvel came along and they started buying entire franchises. They have not needed to make or acknowledge or re-release things like this for at least 20, 30 years now.
Which makes the suggestion, the repeated suggestion that Disney is actually interested in rebooting this really fascinating. Apparently they tried a few times, like Colin Trevorrow was interested in 2012, Blomkamp in 2017. But last year it was announced that Bryce Dallas Howard is set to direct, and it would be right to Disney Plus. So, that could be great. Where is this coming from? Oh, right. You're pillaging all of your content for Disney Plus specials like Hocus Pocus and Willow. And I don't even recognize some of the other things that they're producing, like direct to Disney Plus sequels of. And that has to be considered a completely separate genre than the 90s direct to video market that they would do with, like, Crap. Jonah Jafar, I am looking at you. Glaringly.
But you know what? All that being said, though, I'm sitting here going, as a director, I've seen what Bryce Dallas Howard was able to do on The Mandalorian. Mm-hmm. I'm extremely okay with her remaking this movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, like, it's something that could be amazingly done if updated and maybe made just a little bit more exciting. Just a tiny bit more exciting. And also no Pee-wee Herman, please. Thanks. Just please don't make it Chris Pratt.
Oh God. No. Mm. No. It's I think if you're gonna recast Max, what I would say is do what they did here, but not who they did it with.
Yeah.
In that in the original, Paul Reubens wanted to keep the character of Max as much of a mystery as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked not to be credited.
And yeah, like even on Wikipedia currently, he is not included until you get to the actual, like, cast list entry. He's not in the info box. He's not listed in, like, the Google information sheet. The stars of this film are Joey Kramer first, and then Sarah Jessica Parker.
No, that sounds about right.
And you know, one of them had a great career, and the other robbed a Scotiabank a couple of years ago.
Oof, what?
Yeah, so...
I did not know about
Joey
this.
So Joey Kramer, David Freeman, he, you know, he tried to have a career afterwards. He had some Canadian acting credits to his name. But then he seemed to have gotten, you know, like, you get a couple of little charges, and then you get a bad reputation with the cops, and the next thing you know, you're selling illicit narcotics, and then, you know, you're donning a ski mask or some sort of mask, it wasn't detailed, and armed robbing a Scotiabank. You know, that old chestnut. It happens when it becomes too cold in Calgary, some say. It's really fascinating to see a child star, potential child star, and a half decent actor, completely bomb their career and then life. Yow.
And yeah. And oh, apparently I actually have seen, Joey Kramer's first film credit.
Ooh.
He played Tom Selleck's son in 1984's Runaway.
Oh my God. Okay, yeah, like, so in general, from what I understand, that's kind of the characters he got. Like,
yeah.
Just, yeah. One-offs. Normals, whatever, don't worry about it. They're gone the next day. He was literally on Murder, She Wrote. So, you know, like, yep. He was a kid on Murder, She Wrote. Whatever. And yeah, like, his life was so eventful, I suppose, after his career, that in 2018, production began on a documentary called Life After the Navigator, which was released on Blu-ray and unaffiliated with Disney streaming companies.
I can't imagine why.
I can't imagine why. Let me see where those are. One second. Want to see where I can watch it. Just to know where. Paid for money. Let's see here. Tubi. From what I understand, it, like all quality documentaries, and I mean that actually, it's usually the ones that piss off companies the most, is available on Tubi.
Well, and that would explain a thing or two.
Stick that knife in and turn. Turn. Never forget to twist. 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 There we
go. Yeah, you said that documentary was 2018?
It began production in 2018. It was released in 2020.
Oh, it's not even listed on Joey Kramer's IMDb.
Possibly for good reason. I assume it doesn't make him look very good.
True. Like there's a big old gap between 1996 and 2021.
It's funny because like he's listed on theirs. Oh,
oof,
yeah.
My life after the Navigator has been pretty crazy.
Randall had called me one day and said, "Did you hear about Joey?" And I said, "No, I hadn't."
What was it, a bank robbery?
When I saw what had happened, my heart broke.
It's not just a story about a kid actor that goes to jail. It's about what happened. I was hoping they would get a good kid, because it all depended on him.
They wanted somebody who kind of walked in the door and was natural.
And action.
We weren't in it for the money or anything except the adventure.
When I tried to go back to school and be normal, I was anything but normal.
I think Joey was on the verge of massive stardom, to be honest.
Child actors always have problems.
It's almost like being typecast as a kid, and you grow out of being a kid.
And before I knew it, my childhood was gone.
Going on a location to shoot a movie was my favorite thing to do.
Joe just called. Oh, hang on a sec. Dad, can I go to Norway?
We wanted the spaceship to start out to have a certain configuration when it's hovering.
It was a small set, and we had 4 weeks.
We built those steps with steel rods going away from the camera. You couldn't really do that with special effects.
The puck we're in. Wow.
He was small. You couldn't understand him.
We just all had such a great time on the movie. It was terrific.
After I finished Navigator, I didn't really fit in. And I started smoking a lot of dope. I started drinking a lot.
Do us all a favor and kill yourself.
Those choices seem so silly to anybody who's clean and has been all their life.
Felt like I let a lot of people down.
I love you, Joe. I love you.
And I spent some long nights down here. There were some pretty dark times, definitely.
The more we say it, the better it feels.
So every morning, I've got to go to the pharmacy for my methadone.
I was here with guys who had been in and out of jail for most of their lives.
Why is Navigator so revered and special to so many people?
Because it has heart.
Kids were always coming up to me saying, "Oh, you were the dad in Flight of the Navigator."
It's a really fun movie with a great message about love and family.
It's another world in which anything is possible.
When we do movies, it lasts forever.
It's lovely when they come up and they say, "Oh, my favorite movie is Flight of the Navigator." It's not Alien, it's Flight of the Navigator.
I was the movie star kid who had no identity, and now I do. Now I do.
Yeah, I mean, like, this cast in general is just such a 80s TV who's who. Because, I mean, like, was there, like, the two biggest actors here are Howard Hessman and Sarah Jessica Parker. And after that, you have, like, Cliff DeYoung, where I say the name and it means nothing?
Nothing.
But I promise you, if you've watched television, you have seen this man.
I mean, he's appeared as a guest star on so much network television. All of
exactly.
The television. But I can't think of a single character he has ever played. Oh, burn.
Oh, I can't specifically, but I think he was generally like dads, lawyers. like pretty much your generic male roles, which, I mean, maybe not significant, but you got to give him points for consistency.
I mean, hey, it's a paycheck.
Oh, yeah.
And he's in more movies than I've ever been in. Oh.
True. And actually, though, we have covered another one of his movies, because I completely forgot he's the dad in The Craft.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I still can't remember that character, but at least I remember that movie. Hurrah.
Yeah. Hurrah. Oh, no. The dad in The Craft is not there to be remembered.
Oh, no, no, no. He is a 90s dad in a chick flick. Vamoose, get out of here. Be a cliche and say your line and then get the hell out so that she can go do her thing, you bastard. This film, despite its rather blasé-ness and lack of major stars and lack of credit to its main star at the time that could have actually been a draw, idiots. God damn it, sometimes. It made $18 million or $18.5 million against its $9 million box office, which at the time, keep in mind that like marketing then wasn't, especially for this, marketing then wasn't like the equal of your budget. So you have to times that too. No, this made a healthy amount of money for a live action Disney film at the time. To the point, of course, as we said before, they have considered sequels multiple times, but it didn't make enough money. Not enough money. So that is why it has languished mostly in relative obscurity. Huzzah. Huzzah for mediocrities. Huzzah.
Well, and, you know, I can see that because, like, in terms of children's films, and at the end of the day, this is, of course, a children's film. It's at that midpoint where I could see kids being attracted to it and begging their parents to take them to see it. But most kids' films, I think, really succeed on repeat business. I don't see kids really begging their parents to take them to see it again.
Yeah, and this film specifically would have come at the end of Disney's theatrical re-release approach, in which they said, fuck you, VHS, you bastards, you pirates, you, and would simply re-release their films on a schedule to the theater. And that was expected how you would watch Disney films. Unless, of course, you paid for that oh-so-sweet American Disney Channel. Mm-mm, delicious. But this would have, like, seriously relied on rewatch and not rental. Rental was not a concept Disney wanted to get into at this time. I don't think this got rental until, like, 90, 91 or something like that, if I recall. And yeah, there's no real draw. I can see how there's aspects of a draw from Max, but you're not using him properly. You're not making the most Robin Williams you can make of the character. And you always have to make the most Robin Williams. Don't be abusive to them like they were to Robin Williams. Don't just outright steal half of the content that he produces and not pay him for it. Pay your actors. That is important. But make the most out of it.
For anyone listening who is wondering, do a bit of a Google or a Wikipedia search into the history of Aladdin. I'm just saying.
And then cry. And then cry. I glare. Yeah. And then understand why I glare at Return of Jafar. Glaring. Hate you. but yeah, like, you've got draw there. You've got Pee-wee Herman at his height. Run with it. Run with it. Have him front and center. This could have easily made triple its budget. Quadruple its budget. quintupled its budget, hey! But no, no, they want it to be coy. And this entire film, if there is a complaint to be made about this film, it's that it suffers from being too coy. Stop. Have fun. Go a little more all out. No one needs to be that professional at your age. Be a child, goddammit.
Yeah. Yeah, and speaking of which, like, as much as Joey Kramer is doing an overall good job playing David, I don't know if you noticed, there were a couple of points where he gets almost too old mannish.
Yeah, he's a really curmudgeon little kid. Damn, kid.
When he discovers music videos, and you're getting the "that's not music," and then Lynyrd Skynyrd or something comes on the radio and he's like, "that's real music." Like, you're getting the "that's not music" speech from a 12-year-old.
Yeah, that's super special. A 12-year-old whose family listened to Grease Lightning. The reason that was in there is because this movie is directed by Randall Kleiser, who also directed Grease. So
yep.
He snuck in an outside studio's product and made Disney pay him a royalty. Sneaky, sneaky, sneaky. Well done. This kid's a real old man, and I'm not saying that it doesn't work. It does work, and it's appropriate for his fish out of water, but it certainly does feel funny just how fish out of watery he is when it's like, oh yeah, yeah, such a great difference between 1978 and 1986. That really,
yeah,
those are the formative years. I type on the internet to Twitter in hashtag mega morons, hashtag restore the Snyder shake McDonald's. You know, like, I could think of when I considered how like out of time he is, oh my god, I'll never recover, is this bit from Harvey Birdman where the Jetsons show up to sue the past for ruining the environment. And George goes, "Hello, caveman! I am from the future year of 1999! And it's like, the movies, or the show's produced in 2006, and like, Harvey looks at a calendar that says 2006, and it's like, oh, okay, all right. That's all I could think of, is just George Jetson being like, I am from the future! Okay, settle down. The Transformers are neat, but not much else has changed. And this is a kid who doesn't notice these changes either, really, until they're pointed out. Like, he gets dragged to a cop shop after running home through town. So he doesn't notice that cars are different. He doesn't notice that fashion is different. He doesn't notice that, like, hey, those cops have white boxes with screens on them on their desks. The fuck is that? No. He's not interested at all. This is a very unobservant child. Kudos, I mean, to a lazy navigator.
Yeah.
No wonder you fucking crashed.
I mean, with some of that, I could let go because a lot of the time when he's at the police station, he's kind of kept away from the desks. So I could kind of maybe see him not really noticing the computers. But then he gets to NASA. And
there are no flared bottoms. There are no flared bottoms. Where the hell are the flared bottoms? Why is everyone wearing straighter legs?
How is it that he's seems pretty okay with the delivery robot, but music videos are a problem?
Mm-hmm. See, like, a delivery robot is at least something that makes sense. Like, you know, you read about robots and the robot will be your butler. Boop, 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 boop. You know, you've seen cartoons of that. Prior to the advent of music videos, it's not like the concept of music videos came up in speculative fiction that a child would read or watch or something. It's not that kind of an idea. It came up in speculative fiction, yes, but like, I'm pretty sure this kid isn't reading Philip K. Dick.
I would imagine not. But also to, as much as I've just kind of disputed your point with his about how he's too accepting of the computers, I'm not going to go back and reinforce your point by pointing out that all of the toys that are in his room when he arrives at NASA are from 1986. And he doesn't question any of it.
Why the fuck would he give a shit about this pile of Transformers? He doesn't know what a goddamn Transformer is.
Precisely, because Transformers, G.I. Joe, and the fact that this kid got a water moccasin, which I believe was fairly hard to find. I'm jealous as hell. But those two properties were, if I remember correctly, 1984.
Correct. And he, Dunn, would not have known anything about it. The entire concept of that approach to action figures would pretty much be foreign to him.
And he does at least have the decency to ask, why isn't Starsky and Hutch on TV?
It's the most important question of the day. Any day, really.
I would have liked that to have been followed up by a Knight Rider reference, but...
I've got one question for... Okay, yeah, 1970. Why wasn't this kid, like, wicked into Star Wars? And I know the answer. It's because they didn't own the rights at the time to Star Wars, but, like...
Yeah.
When they remake this, this kid's gonna be wicked into fucking Star Wars.
Oh, I would goddamn hope.
Yeah, he was kidnapped 1 year after Star Wars was out. He's exactly the right age. He definitely would have watched that film like six fucking times. He'd be all about the Star Wars. But
and
no Star Wars to be had.
Yeah, and especially where it almost doesn't matter what time period they put the remake in now.
Yeah.
That kid is into Star Wars.
Although it would work better if they still have him come from 1978 and then pops up in 2022 or whatever. Like, it'll reinforce the time difference far better. Yeah, world of difference. Entirely different concepts. The kid would literally feel like he's coming into the future. And not just, it's been 8 years and this one robot exists at NASA and they don't let anyone else see it unless you're a prisoner and it's lunchtime. It's very specific.
And apparently also it'll drive across the base and nobody will question it or accidentally run it over.
I love that they engineered it to be child size. That's definitely a selling feature and won't at all end up with a dead child being trucked around by a robot. Which is kind of what this film is anyway. In conclusion for myself, it's not bad. It's just, it's like a season one episode of TNG where you're like, when does the plot begin? Oh, this is the plot. Oh, it's almost over. Well, nothing's happened. It's okay that nothing's happened? The plot is that nothing happens. Well, okey-dokey, thank you for taking my money. Disney?
It's science fiction Seinfeld.
It doesn't matter. See, that would have been fantastic if you replace Pee-wee Herman with Jerry Seinfeld.
Oh my god.
Listen, kid, you're really starting to get on my nut. Where are my maps? Just tell me how to get home.
And the irony in what I'm about to say abounds to no end, but this film is basically the cinematic equivalent of popcorn, of all things. Like, it's light, fluffy, satisfying, but at the end of the day, you don't gain anything from it.
Yeah, you crave it, you get overcharged for it, and then you feel really cramped and bloated afterwards. Oh, why do I have the large? Oh.
You'll enjoy it. You may be entertained, but 20 minutes later, you're hungry again.
and speaking of which, now I am hungry. Delicious. I'm sure that the next film we watch will be something that we can enjoy with a full plate in front of us, and it won't at all go horribly wrong or put us off our lunch. After all, we've been watching children's movies, right? It's not like the next film we do would possibly, you know, be horrific. Say, Mike, what's next?
No, it's not as if we're, like, ridiculously late for our Halloween theme or anything, and we're not about to travel to 1982 and actually one of the few John Carpenter films I have not seen, with The Thing.
What? No, wait, save it. We'll get into that. How the hell? Anyway, I'm gonna restrain my response. Restrained. So look forward to that next week, because it's gonna be ghoulish fun. Ooh, spooky. Yeah, the Halloween cliches, blah 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 blah. If you're not a serial killer, please contact us at
So if you want to yell at me for all the classic films that I have not seen before doing a film review show, you can reach us at realgeekshfx@gmail.com or on Twitter at realgeekshfx. Or if you need to curse me out directly, you can always find me as the Maritime Lord on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Or themaritimelord@gmail.com if you need longer form to yell at me.
Whereas I can be found at Friday in Halifax on Twitter and Crash and Burn everywhere else. And are you telling me that you've never watched Citizen Kane on an iPod classic as Orson Welles intended?
No, I have not, but I have heard pretty much his entire run as Lamont Cranston on the original Shadow radio broadcasts, if that counts.
I mean, that's equally nerdy. Yeah, judges? Yeah, they're saying it's okay. Yeah. So join us next time as we answer the eternal question, who goes there?